"Do with it," I said, remembering Dr. Bledsoe's threat. "How could he have anything to do with your being on this bus?" he said. He winked, his eyes twinkled. "All right, forget what I've said. But for God's sake, learn to look beneath the surface," he said. "Come out of the fog, young man. And remember, you don't have to be a complete fool in order to succeed. Play the game, but don't believe in it. That much you owe yourself. Even if it lands you in a straitjacket or a padded cell, play the game, but play it your own way. Part of the time, at least. Play the game, but raise the ante, my boy. Learn how it operates. Learn how you operate. I wish I had time to tell you only a fragment. We're an ass-backward people, though. You might even beat the game. It's really a very crude affair. Really pre-Renaissance. And that game has been analyzed, put down in books. But down here, they've forgotten to take care of the books. And that's your opportunity. You're hidden right out in the open. That is, you would be if you only realized it. They wouldn't see you because they don't expect you to know anything, since they believe they've taken care of that. "Man, who's this they you talking so much about?" said Crenshaw. The vet looked annoyed. "They," he said. "They? The same they we always mean. The white folks, authority, the gods, fate, circumstances. The force that pulls your strings until you refuse to be pulled anymore. The big man who's never there where you think he is." Crenshaw grimaced. "You talk too damn much, man," he said. "You talk and you don't say nothing." "Oh, I have a lot to say, Crenshaw. I put into words things which most men feel, if only slightly. Sure, I'm a compulsive talker of a kind, but I'm really more clown than fool." "But Crenshaw," he said, rolling a wand of the newspaper which lay across his knees, "you don't realize what's happening. Our young friend is going north for the first time." "It is for the first time, isn't it?"
"You're right," I said.
"Of course. Were you ever north before, Crenshaw?"
"I've been all over the country," Crenshaw said. "I know how they do wherever they do it. And I know how to act, too. Besides, you ain't going north, not the real north. You going to Washington. It's just another southern town."
"Yes, I know," the vet said. "But think of what this means for the young fellow. He's going free, in the broad daylight, and alone. I can remember when young fellows like him had first to commit a crime or be accused of one before they tried such a thing. Instead of leaving in the light of morning, they went in the dark of night. And no bus was fast enough. Isn't that so, Crenshaw?"
Crenshaw stopped unwrapping a candy bar and looked at him sharply, his eyes narrowed.
"How the hell I know," he said. "I'm sorry, Crenshaw," the vet said. "I thought that as a man of experience..." "Well, I ain't had that experience. I went north of my own free will."
"But haven't you heard of such cases?"
"He ain't experiencing," Crenshaw said.
"No, it isn't, but... since there's always an element of crime and freedom..."
"I ain't committed no crime."
"I didn't mean that you had," the vet said. "I apologize. Forget it."
Crenshaw took an angry bite from his candy bar, mumbling,
"I wish you'd hurry up and get depressive. Maybe then you won't talk so damn much."
"Yes, doctor," the vet said mockingly. "I'll be depressive soon enough, but while you eat your candy, just allow me to chew the rag. There's a kind of substance in it."
"Oh, quit trying to show off your education," Crenshaw said. "You riding back here in the Jim Crow just like me. Besides, you a nut."
The vet winked at me, continuing his flow of words as the bus got underway. We were going at last, and I took a last, longing look as the bus shot around the highway which circled the school. I turned and watched it recede from the rear window. The sun caught its treetops, bathed its low-set buildings and ordered grounds. Then it was gone. In less than 5 minutes, the spot of earth which I identified with the best of all possible worlds was gone, lost within the wild, uncultivated countryside. A flash of movement drew my eye to the side of the highway now, and I saw a moccasin wiggle swiftly along the gray concrete, vanishing into a length of iron pipe that lay beside the road. I watched the flashing past of cotton fields and cabins, feeling that I was moving into the unknown. The vet and Crenshaw prepared to change buses at the next stop, and upon leaving, the vet placed his hand upon my shoulder and looked at me with kindness, and, as always, he smiled.
"Now is the time for offering fatherly advice," he said. "But I'll have to spare you that, since I guess I'm nobody's father except my own." "Well, perhaps that's the advice to give you. Be your own father, young man, and remember the world is possibility, if only you'll discover it. Last of all, leave the Mr. Nortons alone, and if you don't know what I mean, think about it. Farewell."
I watched him following Crenshaw through the group of passengers waiting to get on, a short, comical figure turning to wave, then disappearing through the door of the red brick terminal. I sat back with a sigh of relief, yet once the passengers were aboard and the bus was underway again, I felt sad and utterly alone. Not until we were sailing through the Jersey countryside did my spirits begin to rise. Then my old confidence and optimism revived, and I tried to plan my time in the North. I would work hard and serve my employer so well that he would shower Dr. Bledsoe with favorable reports. I would save my money and return in the fall full of New York culture. I'd be indisputably the leading campus figure. Perhaps I would attend town meeting, which I had heard over the radio. I'd learn the platform tricks of the leading speakers, and I would make the best of my contacts. When I met the big men to whom my letters were addressed, I would put on my best manner. I would speak softly in my most polished tones, smile agreeably, and be most polite. And I would remember that if he meant any of the important gentlemen, should begin a topic of conversation, I would never begin a subject of my own, which I found unfamiliar. I would smile and agree. My shoes would be polished, my suit pressed, my hair dressed, not too much grease, and parted on the right side. My nails would be clean and my armpits well deodorized. You had to watch the last item. You couldn't allow them to think all of us smelled bad. The very thought of my contacts gave me a feeling of sophistication, of worldliness, which, as I fingered the 7 important letters in my pocket, made me feel light and expansive. I dreamed with my eyes gazing blankly upon the landscape until I looked up to see a red cap frowning down. Buddy, you getting off here? He said. If so, you better get started.
Oh, sure, I said, beginning to move. Sure, but, how do you get to Harlem?
Well, that's easy, he said. You just keep heading north.
And while I got down my bags and my prized briefcase, still as shiny as the night of the Battle Royal, he instructed me how to take the subway. Then I struggled through the crowd. Moving into the subway, I was pushed along by the milling salt-and-pepper mob, seized in the back by a burly, blue-uniformed attendant about the size of supercargo, and crammed, bags and all, into a train that was so crowded that everyone seemed to stand with his head back and his eyes bulging like chickens frozen at the sound of danger. Then the door banged behind me, and I was crushed against a huge woman in black who shook her head and smiled while I stared with horror at a large mole that arose out of the oily whiteness of her skin like a black mountain sweeping out of a rain-wet plain. And all the while, I could feel the rubbery softness of her flesh against the length of my body. I could neither turn sideways, nor back away, nor set down my bags. I was trapped. So close that simply by nodding my head, I might have brushed her lips with mine. I wanted desperately to raise my hands to show her that it was against my will. I kept expecting her to scream until finally the car lurched and I was able to free my left arm. I closed my eyes, holding desperately to my lapel. The car roared and swayed, pressing me hard against her.
but when I took a furtive glance around, no one was paying me the slightest attention. And even she seemed lost in her own thoughts. The train seemed to plunge downhill now, only to lunge to a stop that shot me out upon a platform, feeling like something regurgitated from the belly of a frantic whale. Wrestling with my bags, I swept along with the crowd, up the stairs, into the hot street. I didn't care where I was. I would walk the rest of the way. For a moment, I stood before a shop window staring at my own reflection in the glass, trying to recover from the ride against the woman. I was limp, my clothing wet. "But you're up north now," I told myself. "Up north." Yes, but suppose she had screamed. The next time I used the subway, I'd always be sure to enter with my hands grasping my lapels, and I'd keep them there until I left the train. Why, my God, they must have riots on those things all the time. Why hadn't I read about them? I had never seen so many black people against a background of brick buildings, neon signs, plate glass, and roaring traffic. Not even on trips I had made with the debating team to New Orleans, Dallas, or Birmingham. They were everywhere, so many, and moving along with so much tension and noise that I wasn't sure whether they were about to celebrate a holiday or join in a street fight. There were even black girls behind the counters of the 5 and 10 as I passed. Then, at the street intersection, I had the shock of seeing a black policeman directing traffic, and there were white drivers in the traffic who obeyed his signals as though it was the most natural thing in the world. Sure, I had heard of it, but this was real. My courage returned. This really was Harlem. And now all the stories which I had heard of the city within a city leaped alive in my mind. The vet had been right. For me, this was not a city of realities, but of dreams, perhaps because I had always thought of my life as being confined to the South. And now, as I struggled through the lines of people, a new world of possibility suggested itself to me, faintly, like a small voice that was barely audible in the roar of city sounds. I moved, wide-eyed, trying to take the bombardment of impressions. Then I stopped still. It was ahead of me, angry and shrill, and upon hearing it, I had a sensation of shock and fear such as I had felt as a child when surprised by my father's voice. An emptiness widened in my stomach. Before me, a gathering of people were almost blocking the walk, while above them, a short, squat man shouted angrily from a ladder to which were attached a collection of small American flags.
"We gone chase him out," the man cried. "Out! Tell him about it, Rossman," a voice called.
And I saw the squat man shake his fist angrily over the uplifted faces, yelling something in a staccato West Indian accent at which the crowd yelled threateningly. It was as though a riot would break any minute, against whom, I didn't know. I was puzzled both by the effect of his voice upon me and by the obvious anger of the crowd. I had never seen so many black men angry in public before, and yet others passed the gathering by without a glance. And, as I came alongside, I saw two white policemen talking quietly with one another, their backs turned as they laughed at some joke. Even when the shirt-sleeved crowd cried out an angry affirmation of some remark of the speaker, they paid no attention. I was stunned. I stood gaping at the policeman, my bag settling upon the middle of the walk until one of them happened to see me and nudged the other, who chewed lazily upon a wad of gum.
"What can we do for you, bud?" he said.
I was just wondering, I said, before I caught myself.
"Yeah?
I was just wondering how to get to Men's House, sir," I said.
"Is that all?"
"Yes, sir," I stammered.
"You're sure?"
"Yes, sir."
"He's a stranger," the other said. "Just coming to town, bud?"
Yes, sir, I said. I just got off the subway.
"You did, huh? Well, you want to be careful."
"Oh, I will, sir."
"That's the idea. Keep it clean," he said,
and directed me to Men's House. I thanked them and hurried on. The speaker had become more violent than before, and his remarks were about the government.
The clash between the calm of the rest of the street and the passion of the voice gave the scene a strange, out-of-joint quality, and I was careful not to look back, lest I see a riot flare. I reached Men's House in a sweat, registered, and went immediately to my room. I would have to take Harlem a little at a time. It was a clean little room with a dark orange bedspread. The chair and dresser were maple, and there was a Gideon Bible lying upon a small table. I dropped my bags and sat on the bed. From the street below came the sound of traffic, the larger sound of the subway, the smaller, more varied sounds of voices. Alone in the room, I could hardly believe that I was so far away from home, yet there was nothing familiar in my surroundings, except the Bible. I picked it up and sat back on the bed, allowing its blood-red-edged pages to ripple beneath my thumb. I remember how Dr. Bledsoe could quote from the book during his speeches to the student body on Sunday nights. I turned to the book of Genesis, but could not read. I thought of home and the attempts my father had made to institute family prayer, the gathering around the stove at mealtime and kneeling with heads bowed over the seats of our chairs, his voice quavering and full of church house rhetoric and verbal humility. But this made me homesick, and I put the Bible aside. This was New York. I had to get a job and earn money. I took off my coat and hat and took my packet of letters and lay back upon the bed, drawing a feeling of importance from reading the important names. What was inside, and how could I open them undetected? They were tightly sealed. I had read that letters were sometimes steamed open, but I had no steam. I gave it up. I really didn't need to know their contents, and it would be not honorable or safe to tamper with Dr. Bledsoe. I knew already that they concerned me and were addressed to some of the most important men in the whole country. That was enough. I caught myself wishing for someone to show the letters to, someone who could give me a proper reflection of my importance. Finally, I went to the mirror and gave myself an admiring smile as I spread the letters upon the dresser like a hand of high trump cards. Then, I began to map my campaign for the next day. First, I would have a shower, then get breakfast. All this very early. I'd have to move fast. With important men like that, you had to be on time. If you made an appointment with one of them, you couldn't bring them any slow CP colored people's time. Yes. And I would have to get a watch. I would do everything to schedule. I recalled the heavy gold chain that hung between Dr. Bledsoe's vest pockets and the air with which he snapped his watch open to consult the time, his lips pursed, chin pulled in so that it multiplied, his forehead wrinkled. Then he'd clear his throat and give a deeply intoned order, as though each syllable were pregnant with nuances of profoundly important meaning. I recalled my expulsion, feeling quick anger and attempting to suppress it immediately. But now I was not quite successful. My resentment stuck out at the edges, making me uncomfortable. Maybe it was best, I thought hastily. Maybe, if it hadn't happened, I would never have received an opportunity to meet such important men face to face. In my mind's eye, I continued to see him gazing into his watch. But now, he was joined by another figure, a younger figure. Myself, become shrewd, suave, and dressed not in somber garments like his old-fashioned ones, but in a dapper suit of rich material, cut fashionably like those of the men you saw in magazine ads, the junior executive types in Esquire. I imagined myself making a speech and caught in striking poses by flashing cameras, snapped at the end of some period of dazzling eloquence. A younger version of the doctor, less crude, indeed polished. I would hardly ever speak above a whisper, and I would always be, yes, there was no other word. I would be charming, like Ronald Coleman. What a voice. Of course, you couldn't speak that way in the South. The white folks wouldn't like it, and the Negroes would say that you were putting on. But here, in the North, I would slough off my Southern ways of speech. Indeed, I would have one way of speaking in the North, and another in the South. give them what they wanted down south. That was the way. If Dr. Bledsoe could do it, so could I. Before going to bed that night, I wiped off my briefcase with a clean towel and placed the letters carefully inside. The next morning, I took an early subway into the Wall Street District, selecting an address that carried me almost to the end of the island. It was dark with the tallness of the buildings and the narrow streets. Armored cars with alert guards went past as I looked for the number. The streets were full of hurrying people who walked as though they had been wound up and were directed by some unseen control. Many of the men carried dispatch cases and briefcases, and I gripped mine with a sense of importance. And here and there I saw Negroes who hurried along with leather pouches strapped to their wrists. They reminded me fleetingly of prisoners, carrying their leg irons as they escaped from a chain gang. Yet they seemed aware of some self-importance, and I wished to stop one and ask him why he was chained to his pouch. Maybe they got paid well for this. Maybe they were chained to money. Perhaps the man with run-down heels ahead of me was chained to $1 million. I looked to see if there were policemen or detectives with drawn guns following, but there was no one. Or if so, they were hidden in the hurrying crowd. I wanted to follow one of the men to see where he was going. Why did they trust him with all that money? And what would happen if he should disappear with it? But of course no one would be that foolish. This was Wall Street. Perhaps it was guarded as I had been told post offices were guarded, by men who looked down at you through peepholes in the ceiling and walls, watching you constantly, silently waiting for a wrong move. Perhaps even now an eye had picked me up and watched my every movement. Maybe the face of that clock set in the gray building across the street hid a pair of searching eyes. I hurried to my address and was challenged by the sheer height of the white stone with its sculptured bronze facade. Men and women hurried inside, and after staring for a moment, I followed, taking the elevator and being pushed to the back of the car. It rose like a rocket, creating a sensation in my crotch as though an important part of myself had been left below in the lobby. At the last stop, I left the car and went down a stretch of marble hallway until I found the door marked with the trustee's name. But starting to enter, I lost my nerve and backed away. I looked down the hall. It was empty. White folks were funny. Mr. Bates might not wish to see a Negro the first thing in the morning. I turned and walked down the hall and looked out the window. I would wait a while. Below me lay South Ferry, and a ship and two barges were passing out into the river, and far out and to the right I could make out the Statue of Liberty, her torch almost lost in the fog. Back along the shore, gulls soared through the mist above the docks and down, so far below that it made me dizzy. Crowds were moving. I looked back to a ferry passing the Statue of Liberty now, its backwash a curving line upon the bay and three gulls swooping down behind it. Behind me, the elevator was letting off passengers, and I heard the cheery voices of women going chattering down the hall. Soon, I would have to go in. My uncertainty grew. My appearance worried me. Mr. Bates might not like my suit or the cut of my hair, and my chance of a job would be lost. I looked at his name typed neatly across the envelope and wondered how he earned his money. He was a millionaire, I knew. Maybe he had always been. Maybe he was born a millionaire. Never before had I been so curious about money as now that I believed I was surrounded by it. Perhaps I would get a job here, and after a few years would be sent up and down the streets with millions strapped to my arms, a trusted messenger. Then I'd be sent south again to head the college, just as the mayor's cook had been made principal of the school after she'd become too lame to stand before her stove. Only I wouldn't stay north that long. They need me before that. But now for the interview. Entering the office, I found myself face to face with a young woman who looked up from her desk as I glanced swiftly over the large, light room, over the comfortable chairs, the ceiling-high bookcases with gold and leather bindings, past a series of portraits, and back again to meet her questioning eyes. She was alone, and I thought, well, at least I'm not too early. "Good morning," she said, betraying none of the antagonism I had expected. "Good morning," I said, advancing. How should I begin? "Yes? Is this Mr. Bates' office?" I said. Why, yes, it is, she said. Have you an appointment? No, ma'am, I said, and quickly hated myself for saying ma'am to so young a white woman, and in the North, too. I removed the letter from my briefcase, but before I could explain, she said, may I see it, please? I hesitated. I did not wish to surrender the letter except to Mr. Bates. But there was a command in the extended hand, and I obeyed. I surrendered it, expecting her to open it, but instead, after looking at the envelope, she rose and disappeared behind a panel door without a word. Back across the expanse of carpet to the door, which I had entered, I noticed several chairs, but was undecided to go there. I stood, my hat in my hand, looking around me. One wall caught my eyes. It was hung with three portraits of dignified old gentlemen in winged collars who looked down from their frames with an assurance and arrogance that I had never seen in any except white men and a few bad, razor-scarred Negroes. Not even Dr. Bledsoe, who had but to look around him without speaking to set the teachers to trembling, had such assurance. So these were the kind of men who stood behind him. How did they fit in with the southern white folks, with the men who gave me my scholarship? I was still staring, caught in the spell of power and mystery, when the secretary returned. She looked at me oddly and smiled. I'm very sorry, she said, but Mr. Bates is just too busy to see you this morning and asks that you leave your name and address. You'll hear from him by mail. I stood silent with disappointment. Write it here, she said, giving me a card. I'm sorry, she said again, as I scribbled my address and prepared to leave. I can be reached here at any time, I said. Very good, she said. You should hear very soon. She seemed very kind and interested, and I left in good spirits. My fears were groundless. There was nothing to it. This was New York. I succeeded in reaching several trustees' secretaries during the days that followed, and all were friendly and encouraging. Some looked at me strangely, but I dismissed it, since it didn't appear to be antagonism. Perhaps they're surprised to see someone like me with introductions to such important men, I thought. Well, there were unseen lines that ran from north to south, and Mr. Norton had called me his destiny. I swung my briefcase with confidence. With things going so well, I distributed my letters in the mornings and saw the city during the afternoons. Walking about the streets, sitting on subways beside whites, eating with them in the same cafeterias, although I avoided their tables, gave me the eerie, out-of-focus sensation of a dream. My clothes felt ill-fitting, and for all my letters to men of power, I was unsure of how I should act. For the first time, as I swung along the streets, I thought consciously of how I had conducted myself at home. I hadn't worried too much about whites as people. Some were friendly and some were not, and you tried not to offend either. But here, they all seemed impersonal, and yet, when most impersonal, they startled me by being polite, by begging my pardon after brushing against me in a crowd. Still, I felt that even when they were polite, they hardly saw me, that they would have begged the pardon of Jack the Bear, never glancing his way if the bear happened to be walking along minding his business. It was confusing. I did not know if it was desirable or undesirable. But my main concern was seeing the trustees, and after more than a week of seeing the city and being vaguely encouraged by secretaries, I became impatient. I had distributed all but the letter to a Mr. Emerson, who I knew from the papers was away from the city. Several times I started down to see what had happened, but changed my mind. I did not wish to seem too impatient. But time was becoming short. Unless I found work soon, I would never earn enough to enter school by fall. I had already written home that I was working for a member of the trustee board, and the only letter I had received so far was one telling me how wonderful they thought it was and warning me against the ways of the wicked city. Now I couldn't write them for money without revealing that I had been lying about the job. Finally, I tried to reach the important men by telephone, only to receive polite refusals by their secretaries. But fortunately, I still had the letter to Mr. Emerson. I decided to use it, but instead of handing it over to a secretary, I wrote a letter explaining that I had a message from Dr. Bledsoe and requesting an appointment. Maybe I've been wrong about the secretaries, I thought. Maybe they destroyed the letters. I should have been more careful. I thought of Mr. Norton. If only the last letter had been addressed to him. If only he lived in New York, so that I could make a personal appeal. Somehow I felt closer to Mr. Norton, and felt that if he should see me, he would remember that it was I whom he connected so closely to his fate. Now it seemed ages ago, and in a different season, and a distant land. Actually, it was less than a month. I became energetic and wrote him a letter, expressing my belief that my future would be immeasurably different if only I could work for him, that he would be benefited as well as I. I was especially careful to allow some indication of my ability to come through the appeal. I spent several hours on the typing, destroying copy after copy, until I had completed one that was immaculate, carefully phrased, and most respectful. I hurried down and posted it before the final mail collection, suddenly seized with a dizzy conviction that it would bring results. I remained about the building for 3 days awaiting an answer, but the letter brought no reply, nor, any more than a prayer unanswered by God, was it returned. My doubts grew. Perhaps all was not well. I remained in my room all the next day. I grew conscious that I was afraid, more afraid here in my room than I had ever been in the South. And all the more because here there was nothing concrete to lay it to. All the secretaries had been encouraging. In the evening I went out to a movie, a picture of frontier life with heroic Indian fighting and struggles against flood, storm, and forest fire, with the outnumbered settlers winning each engagement. An epic of wagon trains rolling ever westward. I forgot myself, although there was no one like me taking part in the adventures, and left the dark room in a lighter mood. But that night, I dreamed of my grandfather and awoke depressed. I walked out of the building with a queer feeling that I was playing a part in some scheme which I did not understand. Somehow I felt that Bledsoe and Norton were behind it, and all day I was inhibited in both speech and conduct for fear that I might say or do something scandalous. But this was all fantastic, I told myself. I was being too impatient. I could wait for the trustees to make a move. Perhaps I was being subjected to a test of some kind. They hadn't told me the rules, I knew, but the feeling persisted. Perhaps my exile would end suddenly and I would be given a scholarship to return to the campus. But when? How long? Something had to happen soon. I would have to find a job to tide me over. My money was almost gone and anything might happen. I had been so confident that I had failed to put aside the price of train fare home. I was miserable, and I dared not talk to anyone about my problems, not even the officials at Men's House, for since they had learned that I was to be assigned to an important job, they treated me with a certain deference. Therefore, I was careful to hide my growing doubts. After all, I thought, I might have to ask for credit, and I'll have to appear a good risk. No. The thing to do was to keep faith. I'd start out once more in the morning. Something was certain to happen tomorrow, and it did. I received a letter from Mr. Emerson. It was a clear, bright day when I went out, and the sun burned warm upon my eyes. Only a few flecks of snowy cloud hung high in the morning blue sky, and already a woman was hanging wash on a roof. I felt better walking along. A feeling of confidence grew. Far down the island, the skyscrapers rose tall and mysterious in the thin pastel haze. A milk truck went past. I thought of school. What were they doing now on the campus? Had the moon sunk low and the sun climbed clear? Had the breakfast bugle blown? Did the bellow of the big seed bull awaken the girls in the dorms this morning, as on most spring mornings when I was there, sounding clear and full above bells and bugles and early workaday sounds? I hurried along, encouraged by the memories, and suddenly I was seized with a certainty that today was the day. Something would happen. I patted my briefcase, thinking of the letter inside. The last had been first. A good sign. Close to the curb ahead, I saw a man pushing a cart piled high with rolls of blue paper, and I heard him singing in a clear, ringing voice. It was a blues, and I walked along behind him, remembering the times that I had heard such singing at home. It seemed that here, some memories slipped around my life at the campus and went far back to things I had long ago shut out of my mind. There was no escaping such reminders.
She got feet like a monkey, legs like a frog, Lord, Lord. But when she starts to loving me, I holler, woo! God dog, 'cause I loves my baby better than I do myself.
And as I drew alongside, I was startled to hear him call to me.
Look here, buddy.
Yes, I said, pausing to look into his reddish eyes.
Tell me just one thing this very fine morning. Hey, wait a minute, Daddy-O. I'm going your way.
What is it, I said.
What I want to know is, he said, is you got the dog.
Dog? What dog?
Show, he said, stopping this cart and resting it on its support. That's it? Who?
He halted to crouch with one foot on the curb like a country preacher about to pound his Bible.
Got the dog,
his head snapping with each word like an angry rooster's. I laughed nervously and stepped back. He watched me out of shrewd eyes.
Oh, God, dog, Daddy-O, he said with a sudden bluster. Who got the damn dog? Now, I know you from down home. How come you trying to act like you never heard of that before? Hell, ain't nobody out here this morning but us colored. Why are you trying to deny me?
Suddenly, I was embarrassed and angry. Deny you? What do you mean?
Just answer the question. Is you got him or ain't you?
A dog?
Yeah, the dog.
I was exasperated. No, not this morning, I said, and saw a grin spread over his face.
Wait a minute, Daddy, now don't go get mad. Damn, man, I thought sure you had him,
he said, pretending to disbelieve me. I started away, and he pushed the cart beside me. And suddenly I felt uncomfortable. Somehow he was like one of the vets from the Golden Day.
Well, maybe it's the other way round, he said. Maybe he got hold to you.
Maybe, I said.
If he is, you lucky it's just a dog. 'Cause, man, I tell you, I believe it's a bear that's got hold to me.
A bear?
Hell yeah, the bear. Can't you see these patches where he's been clawing at my behind?
Pulling the seat of his Charlie Chaplin pants to the side, he broke into deep laughter.
Man, this Harlem ain't nothing but a bear's den. But I tell you one thing, he said with swiftly sobering face. It's the best place in the world for you and me. And if times don't get better soon, I'm going to grab that bear and turn him every way but loose.
Don't let him get you down, I said.
No, Daddy-O, I'm going to start with one my own size.
I tried to think of some saying about bears to reply, but remembered only Jack the Rabbit, Jack the Bear, who were both long forgotten and now brought a wave of homesickness. I wanted to leave him, and yet I found a certain comfort in walking along beside him, as though we'd walked this way before through other mornings in other places. What is all that you have there? I said, pointing to the rolls of blue paper stacked in the cart.
Blueprints, man. Here I got about 100 pounds of blueprints, and I couldn't build nothing.
What are they blueprints for? I said.
Damn if I know. Everything. Cities, towns, country clubs, some just buildings and houses. I got damn near enough to build me a house if I could live in a paper house like they do in Japan. I guess somebody done changed their plans, he added with a laugh. I asked the man why they getting rid of all this stuff, and he said they get in the way so every once in a while they have to throw them out to make place for the new plans. Plenty of these ain't never been used, you know?
You have quite a lot, I said.
Yeah, this ain't all, neither. I got a couple of loads. There's a day's work right here in this stuff. Folks is always making plans and changing them.
Yes, that's right, I said, thinking of my letters. But that's a mistake. You have to stick to the plan. He looked at me suddenly grave.
You kind of young, Daddy-O, he said.
I did not answer. We came to a corner at the top of a hill.
Well, Daddy-O, it's been good talking with a youngster from the old country, but I got to leave you now. This here's one of them good old downhill street. I can coast a while and won't be worn out at the end of the day. Damn if I'm gonna let 'em run me into my grave. I'll be seeing you again sometime, and you know something?
What's that?
I thought you was trying to deny me at first, but now I'll be pretty glad to see you.
Well, I hope so, I said. And you take it easy.
Oh, I'll do that. All it takes to get along in this here man's town is a little shit, grit, mother wit. And man, I was born with all three. In fact, I'm a seventh son of a seventh son, born with a caul over both eyes and raised on black cat bones, High John the Conqueror, and greasy greens. He spieled with twinkling eyes, his lips working rapidly. You dig me, Daddy?
You're going too fast, I said, beginning to laugh.
Okay. I'm slowing down. I'll verse you, but I won't curse you. My name is Peter Wheatstraw. I'm the devil's only son-in-law, so roll 'em. You a southern boy, ain't you?
He said, his head to one side like a bear's.
Yes, I said. Well, get with it. My name's Blue, and I'm coming at you with a pitchfork. Fee, fi, fo, fop. Who wants to shoot the devil one, Lord God, a stingray?
He had me grinning despite myself. I liked his words, though I didn't know the answer. I'd known the stuff from childhood, but had forgotten it. Had learned it back of school.
You digging me, Daddy? He laughed. But look me up sometimes. I'm a piano player and a rounder, a whiskey drinker and a pavement pounder. I'll teach you some good, bad habits. You'll need 'em. Good luck, he said.
So long, I said, and watched him going. I watched him push around the corner to the top of the hill, leaning sharp against the cart handle, and heard his voice arise, muffled now, as he started down.
She's got feet like a monkey. Legs. Legs. Legs like a mad bulldog.
What does it mean, I thought. I'd heard it all my life, but suddenly the strangeness of it came through to me. Was it about a woman or about some strange sphinx-like animal? Certainly his woman, no woman, fitted that description. And why describe anyone in such contradictory words? Was it a sphinx? Did old chaplain pants, old dusty butt, love her or hate her? Or was he merely singing? What kind of woman could love a dirty fellow like that anyway? And how could even he love her if she was as repulsive as the song described? I moved ahead. Perhaps everyone loved someone. I didn't know. I couldn't give much thought to love. In order to travel far, you had to be detached, and I had the long road back to the campus before me. I strode along, hearing the Cartman song become a lonesome, broad-toned whistle now that flowered at the end of each phrase into a tremulous, blue-toned chord. And in its flutter and swoop, I heard the sound of a railroad train highballing it, lonely, across the lonely night. He was the devil's son-in-law, all right. And he was a man who could whistle a three-toned chord. God damn, I thought. They're a hell of a people. And I didn't know whether it was pride or disgust that suddenly flashed over me. At the corner, I turned into a drugstore and took a seat at the counter. Several men were bent over plates of food. Glass globes of coffee simmered above blue flames. I could feel the odor of frying bacon reach deep into my stomach as I watched the counterman open the doors of the grill and turn the lean strips over and bang the door shut again. Above, facing the counter, a blonde, sunburned college girl smiled down, inviting all and sundry to drink a Coke. The counterman came over.
I got something good for you, he said, placing a glass of water before me. How about the special?
What's the special?
Poke chops, grits, one egg, hot biscuits, and coffee.
He leaned over the counter with a look that seemed to say, there, that ought to excite you, boy. Could everyone see that I was Southern? I'll have orange juice, toast, and coffee, I said coldly. He shook his head.
You fool me, he said, slamming two pieces of bread into the toaster. I would have sworn you were a poke chop man. Is that juice large or small?
Make it a large, I said. I looked silently at the back of his head as he sliced an orange, thinking, I should order the special and get up and walk out. Who does he think he is? A seed floated in the thick layer of pulp that formed at the top of the glass. I fished it out with a spoon and then downed the acid drink, proud to have resisted the pork chop and grits. It was an act of discipline, a sign of the change that was coming over me, and which would return me to college a more experienced man. I would be basically the same, I thought, stirring my coffee, yet so subtly changed as to intrigue those who had never been north. It always helped at the college to be a little different, especially if you wished to play a leading role. It made the folks talk about you, try to figure you out. I had to be careful, though, not to speak too much like a northern Negro. They wouldn't like that. The thing to do, I thought with a smile, was to give them hints that whatever you did or said was weighted with broad and mysterious meanings that lay just beneath the surface. They'd love that. And the vaguer you told things, the better. You had to keep them guessing, just as they guessed about Dr. Bledsoe. Did Dr. Bledsoe stop at an expensive white hotel when he visited New York? Did he go on parties with the trustees? And how did he act? Man, I bet he has him a fine time. They tell me when old Doc gets to New York, he don't stop for the red lights. Say he drinks his good red whiskey and smokes his good black cigars and forgets all about you old know-nothing Negroes down here on the campus. Say when he gets up north, he makes everybody call him Mr. Dr. Bledsoe. I smiled as the conversation came back to my mind. I felt good. Perhaps it was all the best that I had been sent away. I had learned more. Heretofore, all the campus gossip had seemed merely malicious and disrespectful. Now, I could see the advantage for Dr. Bledsoe. Whether we liked him or not, he was never out of our minds. That was a secret of leadership. Strange, I should think of it now, for although I'd never given it any thought before, I seemed to have known it all along. Only here, the distance from the campus seemed to make it clear and hard, and I thought it without fear. Here it came to hand just as easily as the coin which I now placed on the counter for my breakfast. It was 15 cents. And as I felt for a nickel, I took out another dime, thinking, is it an insult when one of us tips one of them? I looked for the counterman, seeing him serving a plate of pork chops and grits to a man with a pale blonde mustache, and stared. Then I slapped the dime on the counter and left, annoyed that the dime did not ring as loud as a 50-cent piece. When I reached the door of Mr. Emerson's office, it occurred to me that perhaps I should have waited until the business of the day was underway. But I disregarded the idea and went ahead. My being early would be, I hoped, an indication of both how badly I wanted work and how promptly I would perform any assignment given me. Besides, wasn't there a saying that the first person of the day to enter a business would get a bargain? Or was that said only of Jewish business? I removed the letter from my briefcase. Was Emerson a Christian name or a Jewish name? Beyond the door, it was like a museum. I had entered a large reception room decorated with cool tropical colors. One wall was almost covered by a huge colored map from which narrow red silk ribbons stretched tautly from each division of the map to a series of ebony pedestals, upon which sat glass specimen jars containing natural products of the various countries. It was an importing firm. I looked around the room, amazed. There were paintings, bronzes, tapestries, all beautifully arranged. I was dazzled and so taken aback that I almost dropped my briefcase when I heard a voice say, "And what would your business be?" I saw the figure out of a collar ad, ruddy face with blonde hair faultlessly in place, a tropical weave suit draped handsomely from his broad shoulders, his eyes gray and nervous behind clear-framed glasses. I explained my appointment. "Oh, yes," he said. "May I see the letter, please?"
I handed it over, noticing the gold links in the soft white cuffs as he extended his hand. Glancing at the envelope, he looked back at me with a strange interest in his eyes and said, "Have a seat, please. I'll be with you in a moment." I watched him leave noiselessly, moving with a long, hip-swinging stride that caused me to frown. I went over and took a teakwood chair with cushions of emerald green silk, sitting stiffly with my briefcase across my knees. He must have been sitting there when I came in, for on a table that held a beautiful dwarf tree, I saw smoke rising from a cigarette in a jade ashtray. An open book, something called Totem and Taboo, lay beside it. I looked across to a lighted case of Chinese design, which held delicate-looking statues of horses and birds, small vases and bowls, each set upon a carved wooden base. The room was quiet as a tomb, until suddenly there was a savage beating of wings, and I looked toward the window to see an eruption of color, as though a gale had whipped up a bundle of brightly colored rags. It was an aviary of tropical birds set near one of the broad windows, through which, as the clapping of wings settled down, I could see two ships plying far out upon the greenish bay below. A large bird began a song, drawing my eyes to the throbbing of its bright blue, red, and yellow throat. It was startling, and I watched the surge and flutter of the birds as their colors flared for an instant, like an unfurled oriental fan. I wanted to go stand near the cage for a better view, but decided against it. It might seem unbusinesslike. I observed the room from the chair. "These folks are the kings of the earth," I thought, hearing the bird make an ugly noise. There was nothing like this at the college museum, or anywhere else that I had ever been. I recalled only a few cracked relics from slavery times, an iron pot, an ancient bell, a set of ankle irons and links of chain, a primitive loom, a spinning wheel, a gourd for drinking, an ugly, ebony African god that seemed to sneer, presented to the school by some traveling millionaire, a leather whip with copper brass, a branding iron with the double letter MM. Though I had seen them very seldom, they were vivid in my mind. They had not been pleasant, and whenever I had visited the room, I avoided the glass case in which they rested, preferring instead to look at photographs of the early days after the Civil War, the times close to those blind Barbie had described. And I had not looked even at these too often. I tried to relax. The chair was beautiful, but hard. Where had the man gone? Had he shown any antagonism when he saw me? I was annoyed that I had failed to see him first. One had to watch such details. Suddenly there came a harsh cry from the cage, and once more I saw a mad flashing as though the birds had burst into spontaneous flame, fluttering and beating their wings maliciously against the bamboo bars, only to settle down just as suddenly when the door opened and the blond man stood beckoning, his hand upon the knob. I went over, tense inside me. Had I been accepted or rejected? There was a question in his eyes.
"Come in, please," he said.
"Thank you," I said, waiting to follow him.
"Please,"
he said with a slight smile. I moved ahead of him, sounding the tone of his words for a sign.
"I want to ask you a few questions,"
he said, waving my letter at two chairs.
"Yes, sir," I said. "Tell me, what is it that you're trying to accomplish?" he said.
"I want a job, sir, so that I can earn enough money to return to college in the fall."
"To your old school?"
"Yes, sir."
"I see."
For a moment he studied me silently.
"When do you expect to graduate?"
"Next year, sir. I've completed my junior classes."
"Oh, you have. That's very good. And how old are you?"
"Almost 20, sir."
"A junior at 19. You are a good student."
"Thank you, sir," I said, beginning to enjoy the interview.
"Were you an athlete?"
he asked.
"No, sir."
"You have the build," he said, looking me up and down.
"You'd probably make an excellent runner, a sprinter."
"I never tried, sir."
And I suppose it's silly even to ask what you think of your alma mater, he said. I think it's one of the best in the world, I said, hearing my voice surge with deep feeling. I know, he said, with a swift displeasure that surprised me. I became alert again as he mumbled something incomprehensible about nostalgia for Harvard Yard. But what if you were offered an opportunity to finish your work at some other college, he said, his eyes widening behind his glasses. His smile had returned. Another college? I asked, my mind beginning to whirl. Why, yes, say, some school in New England. I looked at him speechlessly. Did he mean Harvard? Was this good or bad? Where was it leading? I don't know, sir, I said cautiously. I've never thought about it. I've only a year more, and, well, I know everyone at my old school, and they know me. I came to a confused halt, seeing him look at me with a sigh of resignation. What was on his mind? Perhaps I had been too frank about returning to the college. Maybe he was against our having a higher education. But hell, he's only a secretary. Or is he? I understand, he said calmly. It was presumptuous of me to even suggest another school. I guess one's college is really a kind of mother and father, a sacred matter. Yes, sir, that's it, I said in hurried agreement. His eyes narrowed. But now I must ask you an embarrassing question. Do you mind? Why, no, sir, I said nervously. I don't like to ask this, but it's quite necessary. He leaned forward with a pained frown. Tell me, did you read the letter which you brought to Mr. Emerson? This? He said, taking the letter from the table. Why, no, sir. It wasn't addressed to me, so naturally I wouldn't think of opening it. Oh, of course not. I know you wouldn't, he said, fluttering his hands and sitting erect. I'm sorry. And you must dismiss it like one of those annoying personal questions you find so often nowadays on supposedly impersonal forms. I didn't believe him. But was it open, sir? Someone might have gone into my things. Oh, no, nothing like that. Please, forget the question and tell me, please, what are your plans after graduation? I'm not sure, sir. I'd like to be asked to remain at the college as a teacher or as a member of the administrative staff. And, well, yes. And what else? Well, I guess I'd like to become Dr. Bledsoe's assistant. Oh, I see, he said, sitting back and forming his mouth into a thin-lipped circle. You're very ambitious. I guess I am, sir, but I'm willing to work hard. Ambition is a wonderful force, he said, but sometimes it can be blinding. On the other hand, it can make you successful, like my father. A new edge came into his voice, and he frowned and looked down at his hands, which were trembling. The only trouble with ambition is that it sometimes blinds one to realities. Tell me, how many of these letters do you have? I had about 7, sir, I replied, confused by his new turn. There, 7? He was suddenly angry. Yes, sir, that was all he gave me. And how many of these gentlemen have you succeeded in seeing, may I ask? A sinking feeling came over me. I haven't seen any of them personally, sir. And this is your last letter? Yes, sir, it is, but I expect to hear from the others. They said, of course you will, and from all 7, they're all loyal Americans. There was unmistakable irony in his voice now, and I didn't know what to say. 7, he repeated mysteriously. Oh, don't let me upset you, he said with an elegant gesture of self-disgust. I had a difficult session with my analyst last evening, and the slightest thing is apt to set me off. Like an alarm clock without control. Say, he said, slapping his palms against his thighs, what on earth does that mean? Suddenly he was in a state.